Hello, I'm Simon Thompson, Chair of the UK's Sustainable Finance Education Charter, Chief Executive of the Chartered Banker Institute, and author of Green and Sustainable Finance Principles and Practice. I get to spend a lot of my time speaking with policymakers, regulators, banking and finance professionals on a wide range of green and sustainable finance topics, conversations about climate, about nature, about sustainability, the dependencies, the risks, the impacts of these, conversations about developments in climate finance and how the banking and finance sector, our professions, can lead and support the global transition to net zero. Green conversations, if you like. I've been lucky to meet many, many experts, many inspiring and thought-provoking individuals along the way, and thought I'd record and share some of these green conversations with a wider audience. And what I've been especially looking forward to is this conversation with Sandy Trust, who's head of organizational risk at M&G, the global investment manager. Sandy's an actuary, a council member, and our colleagues and friends at the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries, and the reason we're talking, the co-author of one of the most compelling, thought-provoking, and best-titled papers on climate risk I've read in recent years, and I'd thoroughly recommend you all get a copy of Climate Scorpion: The Sting Is in the Tail. So welcome to this special episode of Green Conversations, recorded on behalf of the 15 professional body members of the Sustainable Finance Education Charter. And welcome, Sandy. Hello.
Good afternoon, Simon. Thank you. What a fantastic introduction. It's a pleasure to be here.
It was a pleasure to read the paper. I read it. It was absolutely one of the best papers I've read. Well, we'll maybe come to this later. When I say it was a pleasure, it's also quite gloomy in places as well, but certainly very thought-provoking. But maybe let's start with a kind of basic question, given that many of those listening to our conversation won't be actuaries, may not have been lucky enough to have worked closely with actuaries during their careers. So why is climate risk a topic of interest to you professionally as an actuary and to your actuarial colleagues in the IFOA?
It's a great question, thank you. And glibly, I suppose actuaries do quite well when the climate is stable and the economy is stable. So it's kind of in our self-interest for the worst possible aspects of climate change not to happen. But I guess I'd maybe put your question in a slightly different way, Simon. So I would say, why is it important for actuaries, or perhaps I should say, risk professionals to work on climate change with the scientists? Because hang on a minute, we've had thousands of scientists producing tens of thousands of pages of science. What could actuaries possibly add? What could risk professionals possibly add? And actually, this has been one of my biggest learnings over the course of doing these papers. Thank you very much for the kind words on the title. So this is the third in our series of papers. We did climate emergency, tipping the odds in our favour, and the Emperor's new climate scenarios, and had both the privilege and opportunity to work with some top Earth system scientists along the way. And what we discovered is that scientists think radically differently from risk professionals. So a scientific process, for a good reason. Scientists are very nervous about false positives. They don't want to say things until they're really certain. And that's great. We have a scientific process for a reason. But that can translate into what you call scientific reticence. So a recent science paper on climate change, the journal wouldn't publish it until all the author redacted the phrase 2 degrees of warming would be dangerous, replaced it with 2 degrees of warming might be dangerous. So you can see that kind of really mindset. So scientists wouldn't say an iceberg's present until they've kind of tasted it, touched it, licked it, felt it, prodded it, etc. Whereas obviously from a risk perspective, we would say there might be an iceberg. Oh my goodness, we need to watch out for that. So that's a really important central message and a critical message of climate change. We need to not manage certainly climate policy to best estimate consensus science. We need to be thinking about tail risks. What's the worst that could happen, and making really sure we avoid that.
And I think that's just that's brilliant for for an audience of, broadly speaking, kind of risk professionals, whether we're in banking or investment or insurance or actuaries or whatever part of finance we're in. I think that's something that I hadn't really grasped until I read the paper and when we discussed it. And often in finance, we follow, or at least we should be following, the well-worn mantra of planning for the worst and hoping for the best. I guess what you and your co-authors are saying in the paper, Bart, is that we're not using that mindset sort of here when it comes to addressing kind of climate risk. If anything, we're ignoring the potential worst case scenarios, or at least certainly not giving the emphasis we need. But actually, the other bit that comes out, those worst case scenarios are potentially becoming more and more likely to occur. Hence the sting in the tail risks. So what is that? What is or what are the stings in the tail? What are those tail risks we should be thinking about and considering, and the impacts of these? And is this going to be a mild irritation, a little sting, or is it a fatal strike?
We were just talking before we started, weren't we? And like you, I have the great fortune of meeting lots of interesting people working in the space. And I said to some specialist hurricane risk modelers I met this morning, I said, God, I'd really like one of these conversations to be, don't worry, it's all going really well. You don't need to worry about it. That doesn't seem to be the case with climate change. So just to build a little bit more, imagine you're crossing a river. Well, you don't care too much about the average depth of the river. You care about the deepest point of the river. What the IPCC have done is lots of fantastic science, but it is a consensus-driven process. On top of that, scientific reticence I talked about earlier, another word for consensus you could say is averaging. And just to be clear, I have the utmost respect for climate science, climate scientists. How do they keep going? But anyway, so back to crossing that river. We care about the deepest point of the river. We don't care about the average depth. What is arguably the most critical assumption on the planet today? I put it to you that nothing is more critical than the assumption of how sensitive is the planet to greenhouse gases? Because that drives our carbon budgets, that drives what temperature we think we can get to, that drives how much we can emit. So pretty important assumption. Equilibrium climate sensitivity, that's known as. And technically, it's what temperature would the planet get to if you doubled greenhouse gases and kind of let it come up to equilibrium? And the answer is, if you look at the IPCC, the answer is 3 degrees warming. So if we double greenhouse gases and let the experiment run, obviously that's a simplified version of reality because there are lots of dynamics. But if we doubled greenhouse gases, let the experiment run, we'd eventually get to 3 degrees warming. Oh, okay. And then that translates into carbon budgets and the rest of it. So what's the range of uncertainty around that, I hear you ask? Well, there's a distribution and quite a fat tail to that distribution. So there's a 20% chance that sensitivity is actually 4.5 degrees. Hang on a minute. 3 degrees, 4.5 degrees. Sounds like quite a big difference. And what did you say that chance was? Oh, 20%. Oh, is that a lot? Well, that's more than the chances of losing Russian roulette. And just to put it in perspective, we run our insurance companies to a 0.5% chance of failure, a 1 in 200 chance of failure. So with our planet, we're running it to up to 100 times more likely chance of failure than we're running our insurance companies. So that's what we're talking about when we say the sting in the tail of the distribution of climate sensitivity and the chance that the Earth's climate may be really a lot more sensitive to greenhouse gases than we're expecting. What are the implications of that? Well, that means that we may warm up more quickly than expected, or put another way, carbon budgets are actually much, much smaller than those we're working to. So that was the provocation for the paper. But you also talked about the changing distribution of risk. Are we in the tail? Have things changed? So I'll pick hurricane risk. We had a really good conversation on that this morning. Things which drive hurricane risk are sea surface temperature, wind shear, what's happening with the winds, and one other thing. Anyway, the North Atlantic is getting warmer and warmer, And that will cross a tipping point at about 26.5 degrees Celsius sea surface temperature, beyond which you start to generate more and more hurricanes. So you're going to see changes in frequency and also changes in intensity. Now, if you think about the distribution of risk, that distribution has shifted. We're seeing that clearly in temperatures. We've seen it in flood risk in England and the Great Britain. And so that's the other sting in the tail, is that we're living in the tail of previous distributions. Things, the distribution is shifting, things are getting worse, unfortunately.
I know we always have to be careful in attributing any single extreme weather event to climate change, but there is a body of a standard body of science that says actually, we know the science, don't we? It's basic physics about as oceans warm up and as temperatures warm up, then will become more frequent and more severe. And of course, this week, as we're recording this, there've been the big storms in Dubai and the big flooding events there, which is not part of the world where you perhaps expect these things to be happening. But that again is consistent with what we'd be expecting from global warming and climate change. So you introduced kind of tipping points there, and one of the other really fascinating bits of the paper for me was where you introduced the concept of something you call planetary solvency. I mean, can you tell us a bit more, about that? How's it defined? And I guess most importantly, how solvent are we? Or maybe how close are we to insolvency? Is that famous quote, isn't there, about how did you I became insolvent
Yes.
slowly at first and then very quickly.
Yeah,
So
I
yeah.
think it's attributed to Hemingway, isn't it?
Yeah,
Isn't
it
it
is. It is.
Death and the
That's right.
Ultimate? Yeah, exactly. How did you become insolvent? Well, gradually and then very suddenly. Yeah, exactly. And I think tipping points are something we're intuitively all very used to. If you, I'm sure you don't in the office, but if you tip back in your chair at school, there comes a point where you tip over and there's a big kerfuffle and it's quite a lot more difficult to get back into the stable state. A glass of water or a coffee cup or a wine cup, we can knock and then beyond a certain point it tips and it's much more difficult to put it back. So it's a characteristic of what we call all complex systems. They're in a kind of equilibrium state or dynamic equilibrium state, but if you push them and push them, push, they can tip into a new state and actually become quite stable in that new state. And it can be quite hard to put them back. So, in our global climate system, there are a bunch of tipping points which have been identified. I won't go into them at length. There's lots of fantastic literature. We did cover them briefly in the paper. But to pick one, the Greenland ice sheet, as the ice sheet melts, it reduces in altitude. As it reduces in altitude, the heat increases. As more rocks are uncovered, they kind of suck in more heat. So you get this kind of accelerating melting effect. And it gets to a point where it goes into irreversible collapse. And that's several meters of sea rise. How quickly might that happen? Difficult question, but more quickly than we expect. And then that feeds into ocean currents, and you get this big pulse of cold, fresh water, and that impacts the Labrador Current, and that can start to impact the North Atlantic circulation, and so on and so forth. So it's really in our interest not to go past or very far past 1.5 degrees warming. That's when we start to trigger the tipping points. But this is, although well understood in the scientific community, not well represented in IPCC reports, and I would say not particularly well understood by policymakers and those making decisions. So we see, I would say, inadequate risk mitigation activity. We call it a climate emergency, but our actions are not congruent with the word emergency. If you think about COVID, shutting down travel, the speed with which the vaccine was developed, building whole new hospitals in under 20 weeks, those are emergency actions. Climate change, we're not moving at that pace. So for me, there's a disconnect between what the scientists are saying at the level of concern and their risks like tipping points and the policy action, which is not yet sufficient to really accelerate the transition, which more of which later. So planetary solvency is really taking things which you and I and many people listening to this are very familiar with. Financial services risk management techniques, so very simple risk impact and likelihood matrix, and adapting that for the planet. So rather than credit risk, operational risk, reputational risk, etc., we have climate change, biodiversity, socio-political stability, human mortality, and GDP. Those are our risk dimensions. And then we plot that on the classic risk matrix, likely to impact, and come up with probably quite a scary impact scale, going up to really catastrophic events. So this was, I guess, the genesis of this was a fantastic paper, which I'd encourage everyone to read, Climate Endgame by Luke Kemp. And that really talks about the need to think about ruin scenarios, other degrees of warming we can't adapt to. So that was a provocation. So really, planetary solvency is the application of financial risk management techniques to the planet. Are we going to continue to have a stable biosphere that lets us run our civilization without too much disruption? And crucially, both risk position today, but also risk trajectory. And ultimately, it's designed to be a tool which will simply communicate to policymakers the level of risk and the trajectory, the need to take risk mitigation actions. I suppose actions congruent with the emergency, Monica.
I suppose the good news is we will actually have a stable ecosystem because the Earth is great at tending towards the equilibrium. The question is more whether humans will have a place on that in the future,
Yes.
because isn't it? And that's why we need to be worried about this. And as you said, it's just such a multifaceted problem we're dealing with. I mean, the Climate Scorpion report itself is focused on climate, but you've touched on other areas too, and there's a lot of emphasis on at the moment addressing biodiversity loss and looking at sort of nature-based risks with the work of the Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosures and others and so on. So we're not just trying to solve for the problem of climate change
No.
here. We're trying to solve for these multiple environmental and societal issues too, which adds a further degree of complexity. So yes, have you and your colleagues done any sort of further work on this, or what do we need to look at next, do you
Yeah, I mean, you've got some very difficult exam questions today, Simon, but it's a
feel?
really good question. So, and completely accurate. If it was only climate change, that would be quite a big challenge. But it's not only climate change. So, in the paper, we have a section on risk interconnectedness, and actually the cascading, compacting nature risks. A lovely diagram. I must shout out to my colleague Lucy Say, who put it together. And it starts with climate and biodiversity, and then it goes into the risks they might drive in terms of heat stress, extreme weather, the hurricanes that we've talked about, water stress, drought, which obviously a number of African countries, many other parts of the world are experiencing, and so on. And then that might impact human society through food stress, voluntary migration. People may just find they have to move. You might have some socio-political fragmentation. We've certainly seen some of the states which are not resilient and or not well governed, may descend into turbulent situations. But ultimately, that can all contribute to this relatively novel risk type named derailment risk. And that's where societies are just so busy dealing with these chaotic circumstances. There's kind of things like we saw in Dubai this week, that they just become unable to continue to focus on kind of strategically addressing the drivers of climate change and nature loss. So I've not seen too much quantitative on this. There was a fantastic book that came out in Nature, I think, the day before, on a much more severe risk assessment of climate change and some of the hothouse impacts there. But I've not seen too much done on this quantitatively, but qualitatively there's quite a lot of literature on these cascading, compounding risks. And I suppose that's really what we're trying to do with planetary solvency, is put something together that shows that these, you can't kind of magic say we could magically fix climate change and nature loss just goes away. They're very interconnected.
And also, for anyone looking for an introduction to this whole sort of area and the complexity of it, I can strongly recommend Peter Frankopan's recent book, The Earth Transformed. Although that's a history of these areas, it brings it together. And it's just in my mind because I was lucky enough to see him give a talk in London a week or so ago. One of the great examples he brought out. We talk about this into complexity of climate, environmental issues, social issues, political issues, and so on. One thing I hadn't really understood before was he said, look, so I know about sort of India and China and the border conflicts they have there. Those are conflicts over water scarcity, which I hadn't realized. And because that's where, that's the top of the Himalayas, that's where the water goes down either to the Chinese side or the Indian side, to make it very sort of simple. And that, at least in his view, and he's the Oxford professor of history, kind of knows these things pretty well, I think, says, that's really what's at the heart of that conflict. So it's a conflict for scarce natural resources that are getting scarcer and that will be impacted by kind of climate change and other environmental events. His point was, these aren't theoretical. These are things that are happening in our world now, hence the urgency, which comes back to the point around, that distribution of risk sort of shifting. In fact, some of those risks are crystallizing as we speak. So perhaps they're even sort of more than we think.
So fantastic, actually. Well, you've jogged my memory. It's a fantastic report that you ended, and interconnected disaster risks report, where they look at a couple of these types of risks. But one they look at in particular is water stress. They talk about risk tipping points. So you go, as you kind of talked about, from a point of having enough water for irrigation drinking to not, and that being driven by, again, it's the sort of systems thinking approach. It's not just taking the water out and changes to rainfall patterns. It's also the glaciers melting in the Himalayas, and you go at some point you go past peak melt, and the water coming out of the Himalayas reduces. It's a very real problem. The other book I was going to just recommend, because you look, is Simon Sharp's Five Times Faster. That's an absolutely brilliant kind of summary of the risk management of climate change, or the absence of, and I know we're going to get onto this later, but also some of the opportunities for accelerating things, reasons to be hopeful as well.
Well, actually, let's go on to the reason to be hopeful now, because it's a I mean, as I said, it's a fascinating, very, very thought-provoking paper. But I mean, I'm conscious that by its very nature, it does get one thinking rather existentially about where we are as a species, what we face as
Yes,
individuals,
apologies.
communities, as a species. And I think sometimes there's a feeling that when it comes to tackling these great global challenges like climate change, maybe we have quite limited agency as individuals. I don't share that view myself, but I think there's a lot, I think that's a fairly widely held view. I like to think we all can make a difference if we choose to. So, what practical steps would you recommend that we could and should take as finance professionals and as climate conscious individuals?
It's a really good question as well. I think it is a topic where it's easy to be overwhelmed, and certainly I'm sure you've had these conversations as well. It's a topic where people can become very passionate and then burn out. It's a topic where people can become very concerned, suffer from eco anxiety, real distress, and worry about what the future may hold. So it is we should acknowledge that it's not a straightforward topic. I think certainly, I mean, certainly in a Western liberal democracy, we all do have agency. And certainly those of us in a fortunate position of working for professional bodies or working for a large financial organizations probably have even more agency than some people. I think there's a journey people could go on. I think education is critically important. I think there's a lot of noise about around this topic, so be educated, understand the basics, stay current. There's really great information out there. I think live and examine life can all make personal lifestyle choices which are positive. To be clear, we're not going to personal lifestyle choice our way out of this, but we can all play a part in making the choices that we can, which are positive. But I also really strongly say to people, let go of your eco guilt. This You didn't make this happen. You're part of the system. Make positive choices, but don't beat yourself up if you have to do something you'd prefer not to do. Everyone's in a very specific individual situation, and the choices they can make are different to them. Find a community, whether it's a charity, whether it's a group of your work, whether you maybe you want to try and move your career into this space. I've been lucky enough to be able to do that myself. So you get paid to do this. Vote, and possibly actually even more possible, possibly actually even more important, voting is telling your MP you care. Tell your pension scheme as well that you care about these things. So I think there's a huge amount people can do. I think the other thing is hope. It can be quite difficult to see a route out of this. If you look at lots of the forecasts, it's very difficult to see how we're going to scale renewable energy as quickly as we need to, move to electric vehicles as quickly as we need to. But there are some success stories. Like there are six or seven countries currently running on 100% renewable electricity. You look at the UK grid, and that has really decarbonized, primarily due to offshore wind, and that was driven by policy decisions. You look at electric vehicle adoption in Norway, that was driven by policy decisions. That going back a bit further, you look at France's nuclear fleet, whatever you think of nuclear, that very low carbon energy policy decision. Look at the impact of the Inflation Reduction Act policy decision. Look at the pace the car China's moving policy decision. So if you've not got the message now that I think it's all about government energy policy decisions, that I think is important. That's why I think it's really important to speak to and interact with MPs. And what do those policy decisions do? Well, if you think about human technology disruption, it typically follows that classic S curve. You have early adopters trying to challenge the incumbents, and then suddenly everyone jumps board, and we've seen it from, horses to cars, mobile phones, and renewables are starting to show signs of that. So I really think the energy transition can be much quicker than people think it can be if it follows that exponential classic human technology disruption route. I strongly believe there are a lot of positive socioeconomic tipping points out there, and I also strongly believe that really, it's only government policy that's really going to unlock them.
And we should be optimistic about the pace of that energy transition globally. I think I'm right in saying the latest sort of IEA, the International Energy Agency figures, they're sort of predicting a sort of a, you know, well, was it last year for the first time the sort of majority of new generative capacity was renewable. So that's the new stuff that's been put there. I mean, we're still building too much of the fossil fuel powered stuff. But I think by 2028 or 2029. And these are predictions only, but they are sort of predicting that somewhere close to half of total global transmission capacity will be being produced by renewables, primarily solar and wind. So it was quite an eye-catching figure. I'll have to look that one out and maybe put it in the sort of the notes after we've done this. But sadly, I mean, thanks. What a fascinating conversation. And I guess just to round it off, I'd say as finance professionals, whether we're actuaries, bankers, insurers, investors, accountants, or more, we are all in the business of risk. But how much have we actually been, whether individually, or collectively, really considered climate and environmental risk and potentially these stings in the long tails that, Sandy and his co-authors have pointed out? And I think the clear answer, when you read the paper is, not enough. And that should give us all food for thought, and give us all something to kind of go away, sort of reflect on and engage with, our employers, our policymakers, our colleagues, our friends, our communities, and so on about this. So Sandy, thank you, and to your co-authors and colleagues, our colleagues and friends at the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries for really truly fascinating and thought-provoking green conversation that I know will prompt listeners who haven't yet done so to download a copy of the Climate Scorpion paper. We'll include the link to make that as easy as possible. So
Thank
please,
you.
I urge you, read it and don't get stung. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.